Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast of Bruegel, which is a Brussels-based economics think tank. In our series today, we are revisiting the topic of the day, which is, of course, energy, Europe's energy dependence, where we are now, and the challenges that we have ahead. And with me today, I have my own colleagues in place, our experts that are working very hard every day on updating numbers and telling us where we stand. Let me introduce you briefly to them. Georg Zachmann. Hi, Georg. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Maria.
Simone Tagliapetra. Hi, Simone.
Hello, Maria.
And here with me in the studio, I have Ben McWilliams. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Maria.
So, listen, we have all been reading your pieces with great interest, if not amazement, actually, at the level we are in. And I think this is a good... we are in the middle of the summer, and it's a good time to take stock in terms of where we are, what are the immediate risks, a little bit thinking about the winter ahead, because this is the one that we all have to prepare for. And in fact, in terms of the way that Europe has approached the issue, in terms of sanctions and where we are at this position. So maybe let's start with that, actually, on the sanctions part. Where are we in our relationship with Russia, the way that we limit them, and the way, actually, perhaps more importantly, that they have limited us? Maybe Simone?
Yes, thank you, Maria. I think it is very important to consider that, as a matter of fact, we'll still need to start sanctioning Russia on energy.
Indeed.
Because we agreed back in March to have an embargo on the imports of Russian coal. This embargo will enter into operation in August. We then, after a very difficult conversation among the 27, decided later on for an embargo on oil, an embargo that we know it's partial in the sense that it tackles the seaborne oil imports from Russia, but it has been strengthened also with a ban on the insurance for the shipping, which is important because it might prevent Russia from diverting volumes of oil to third countries. But this embargo will enter into force at the end of the year. So we are in a situation where we have announced the oil embargo, which is the most important one due to the revenues that Russia is making out of oil. But we are not, I mean, we have this time lag where Russia keeps exporting at speed its oil to the global market and also to Europe. And we are not acting. They have been acting vice versa on gas, because on gas, we now have a reduction of the Russian exports to Europe that amount to basically 2/3 of the volumes we used to get from Russia. And this has happened because Russia has decided to make a full weaponization of gas against Europe. And therefore, we haven't even discussed in Europe about sanctioning Russian gas, because that was a too difficult discussion. The Russians did that themselves as a weapon against us.
So we are not sanctioning Russia in any way. At least right now, we're not. We have intentions to do that. We'll come back to the sanctions because I think that's important. But can we perhaps, and I'm looking at you, Ben, can we discuss, because I'm sure our audience will be very interested in understanding where we are in terms of our gas consumption, our gas needs, and of oil, energy, actually, not just gas, the energy picture in Europe right now. And of course, whether we are going to be able to meet our energy needs in the winter.
Sure. So as Simone says, gas is the one fuel where we have held back and we haven't sanctioned Russia even in the future. And the reason is because that was the fuel where we were most dependent on Russia. It was about 40% of our supply before the invasion. And the key factor is that it was all by pipelines, as everybody by now has heard. And these are very difficult to replace with fuel from elsewhere in the world. Where we stand, as Simone says, it's about 2/3 lower now, gas we're getting from Russia compared to last year. So where it used to be about 40% of our supply, now it's between 15 and 20%. That's ahead of actually just these 10 days. There's the big Nord Stream pipeline undergoing maintenance. So at the moment, that's at zero, but that's a normal thing. That's not something to panic about in isolation. I mean, in 10 days' time, if it comes back online, that will be the big question. But for now, that's normal. So we're looking at about 2/3 reduction through Poland, where gas used to transit. Russia stopped. This has gone to zero now for quite some weeks. through Ukraine, gas flows are historically quite low. And Nord Stream, the big German pipeline, which for a long time it was believed would not be interrupted, about 3 weeks ago, and flows were severely interrupted here to about 60% below. And that was the really big move by Russia, where there's no longer any pretense that, I don't think Russia is engaging clearly as an economic partner here, and it's being weaponized for political means. Yeah. And the last pipeline is the Turk Stream one, which flows down the south to Serbia and Hungary particularly, which is still flowing at kind of very high levels, representing the political relationship there. So on gas, that's the situation. I think maybe in a minute we can discuss what Europe needs to do next winter to survive without Russian gas.
No, but can you tell us a little bit? I mean, you went from 40 down to 15%, more or less, sure, ballpark numbers. But the difference has been replaced from elsewhere, right?
Sure. So far, the cuts in Russian gas has been largely replaced by LNG, liquid natural gas imports, and to some extent by increased Norway pipe imports. This is almost exhausted. There's not much more we can do here. That's why countries are scrambling to build more LNG terminals. They think it's necessary. So from where the Russian flows are now, we're really at this crunch inflection point where everything further that's cut by Russia needs to come from the demand side. So whereas so far we've seen very high prices and we've been able to source this in international markets by essentially pricing out others such as Pakistan, Bangladesh, now, the next cuts that come from Russia, if they come ahead of the winter, that has to be demand side. There won't be molecules that can get into the European gas grid. And the ballpark figure is about 15%. So European gas consumption needs to be 15% lower without Russian gas.
Let's stop on this moment, because that's a very important point. So we've reduced all we could. We've replaced all we could. And now there is still some gas of about 50% that is still coming from Russia. But we will not be able to get this in the winter. Is that the big
thing? Indeed. I mean, no, and we haven't, some countries with the payments for ruble schemes made the decision to cut Russian gas. But to be clear, we haven't reduced all the gas. Russia has cut us off and reduced the gas. We've done everything we can to replace it on international markets.
That's right.
That's now largely exhausted. And hence around 15% ballpark is the average number. There's big differences by country,
indeed,
but that's the average number across Europe that we will need to cut demand over the next 10-12 months to survive without Russian gas.
So, Georg, 50% reduction in gas demand, effectively. How are we going to do this?
Yeah, maybe first on the on what Russia has been doing. I mean, also contractually, they have been breaking their contract. So in the last year, the reductions in Russian gas flows to Europe were mainly based on Russia, within the limits of their existing long-term contracts, selling as little as they could. But now, at the beginning now of 2022, they started to not fulfill their gas contracts anymore. So they are in breach of contracts, and of sometimes contracts that have been in place for almost 50 years. So that is really a sea shift in our gas energy relations with Russia. So they have built up a lot of reputation in the past, and they slashed it down in a few months now, which has been a shocking moment for many Europeans. That's why we are now in the situation that we really have to think about what might happen if Russia completely cuts the remaining gas flows. And the decision about whether these gas flows are going to be cut is going to be taken in Moscow. It's not going to be taken in Europe, as we would think. So the decision will be, Putin decides it's now the time to break European unity by essentially stopping gas flows now and hoping to create chaos, or to kind of continue to sell a bit longer gas, make a bit more rubles or euros, and then hope that in the winter there's a better strategic opportunity for them to entirely cut, or kind of put pressure or blackmail Europe on cutting. So we are really in a political situation. It's not economic anymore.
Okay. Can I ask you just on this? So first of all, what does it mean, a breach of contract, in this context? I mean, in normal times it means litigation, but I mean, you know, Europe cannot really take, in what sense can Europe now, you know, take Russia to international courts for this breach of contract? Is this something that is applicable? And the other thing that we often hear is that, why would Russia cut gas further? I mean, the income side. I mean, that there is a disincentive there. Can you talk us a little bit through these arguments?
I presume that for the breach of contract, if we ever enter into a more normal situation back again, I could imagine that European companies might sue Gazprom, and that there will be 5 to 10 year discussions on litigation of this issue. But I mean, that's currently not helping us much. And on the revenue side, I mean, so far Russia has essentially kind of played its monopoly game quite well. So they just reduced flows always to a level that increased prices more than they lost on the side of volumes. So essentially, the prices increased by essentially tenfold between last year and now, while the volumes decreased only by 2/3. So they made more money by selling less gas to us. So therefore, that gives an indication that it might still be commercially attractive for Russia to continue selling us gas at very limited volumes. But there is also a political dimension to that. I think at some point it will be decided politically whether it's opportune to hope that that European unity breaks apart over the gas crisis, whether Germany might be willing to get out of the Western alliance because they don't get Russian gas anymore, or things like that. So I think the end game is a political end game here, but for the time being, they took the commercial benefits of this trade happily.
To just explain, so it's not, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not easy for Russia to redirect its gas elsewhere. So in some ways, there is a dependency also from Russia, with all the provisos that Georg just explained, that, you know, they reduce the quantity at very high price, still very attractive to sell. But it's also not the case that if Europe decided to cut all its energy demands from Russia, that Russia can go elsewhere. Correct?
Yes. What Georg eloquently illustrated is a strategic game. Russia is playing this game strategically. They have been using energy and the reduction of the flows of gas to individual countries in a strategic way, always taking indeed also into consideration the price effects. And since we are in this game, Europe needs to play strategic as well. Now, on the oil embargo front, we haven't been playing a strategic game, because that would have entailed putting a tariff, which we could have leveraged, no, and increased over time to increase pressure on Russia. We decided to announce an embargo that would enter into operation in 6 months' time, providing Russia windfall profits for 6 months and finding other ways to dispatch oil around the world, for example. On gas, it's exactly the same situation. So here we need to be aware of the fact that we have in front of us a country which is strategic, which clearly has a long-term political view that it wants to achieve. And at this point in time, it is willing to compromise even its, for example, gas market. Europe has always been the first gas market of Russia, no? For the sake of a greater aim, which in this case clearly is to get control of Ukraine, of part of it. So I think this is crystal clear. Russia has understood that Europe will not be a market for its gas anymore, because the diversification process that Europe is undergoing is structural. And
that's for the long term, it's not immediate.
Even in the short term, Russia can handle the situation, because they can keep exporting oil. That's where they make, in any case, the bulk of their revenues. And as we can see very clearly also from the database we have at Bruegel tracking the oil exports of Russia, I mean, they find a lot of new customers in India, in China, elsewhere in Asia. So they can buffer this long term in the short term with the oil. So it's crystal clear that now gas is a geopolitical weapon, while the cash machine is the oil export. And they are playing on that, because with oil, they can redirect the flows better than they could do with gas, which is linked to heavy infrastructure that is difficult to build overnight.
So the if Europe were to play a strategic game from a point of weakness, because we all understand that Europe is at the point of weakness now, you know, what are the elements that and we'll come to the demand issue in a minute, because I think that's the next thing to solve. But what is the strategic acts that Europe could do to try and counteract some of the weaknesses, perhaps, Georg?
I think it directly links to the demand issue, because the first point would be on the European side to reduce demand. I mean, if we manage to show to Russia that we are not dependent anymore, because we bring all the options that we have to increase supplies of non-Russian fuels and energy sources, and reduce demand of all types of energy in the European Union, we would be in a much stronger position. If we are not dependent anymore, we can enter into negotiations with Russia over prices that are acceptable to us and over volumes that are acceptable to us. So the first step would be to have a high-level European agreement that we bring all the flexibilities we still have, and we have quite a bit in terms of increasing supplies, be it lignite, coal, nuclear generation assets that are underutilized at the moment, or be it demand reduction, kind of buying out consumers out of existing contracts in order to kind of bridge these 15% that are still lacking for us. And if we can then go to Russia and say, guys, we are able to do that. Now, we are not dependent on you. We still like cheap energy from you if you would want to sell it to us, but only at the price of our choice. We would pool together all our national companies' gas contracts into one European entity and make one offer to Russia. And then it's up to them to decide whether they will be willing to buy, say, sell 50 billion cubic meters for, say, 50 euro per megawatt hour or not. And that would give us a much stronger hand. And I think that should be the way to go.
Well, Ben, why are we not doing that?
One point first on oil, on this strategic game. On oil, Russia can redirect, but Europe still has a very strong hand. You said from a position of weakness on one hand. Europe still provides the ships and the insurance for Russia to send this oil around the world.
Okay.
And that's what we haven't embargoed until next January. And that's now with the G7 and the price cap, these discussions. But we have a strong hand. Just at the moment, we are not using on oil, that first on oil. And then on gas, as Georg has discussed, I mean, doing everything we can to reduce demand, which needs to come from politicians being upfront with people and explaining to them there are trade-offs between gas consumption now, and we want to reduce demand in a coordinated manner, essentially not by a recession. If we're proactive and talking with households, we start doing energy efficiency measures and very quick fix energy efficiency measures. So not the big retrofitting, which takes a while to roll out, but simple things around windows, around doors, communication campaigns to households, explaining what they can do to save energy, which also the International Energy Agency and the European Commission, they were quite proactive. And in the first couple of months of the invasion, I mean, we were making quite promising steps, and they were coming forward with documents detailing all the measures households could do and as economies we could follow in quite a succinct way. But they weren't really picked up by politicians. Instead, we sat there and we kept being complacent, consuming Russian gas, particularly gas, and waited. And now we're in the position where, okay, we're getting closer and closer to the winter, and we're seeing some demand reduction, but not huge demand reduction.
Well, that's seasonal. It's because of the summer, right?
Even factoring in the seasonality, you see some demand reduction. Okay. But on the other hand, prices are 10 times higher.
Indeed.
So the demand reduction we see, because there's lots of legacy contracts which protect consumers and industry, and they don't face today's prices. They face prices of 6 months, 12 months ago, or locked-in prices, which means that the price elasticity is not as high as you might expect otherwise. And also governments. I mean,
but can I? I mean, it feels like we haven't really understood that this is, an urgent situation right now, right? I mean, there's things on the table that you, all three of you, have put. But why are we not doing them, Simone?
I think you're right, Maria. We certainly are into what possibly is the greatest energy crisis that we have ever seen, not only in Europe, but also in the world, and we can discuss the global repercussions of all these, namely for developing countries later. But so far, governments have struggled to talk to people in a clear manner that that's where we are. It is not because of our choices. And therefore, we need to take certain extraordinary steps to react to this. This is something that we could have done several months ago to smooth our situation and to further accelerate the refilling operation of the gas storages. But we are still in a situation where we are burning a lot of gas to produce electricity, while we might have other fuels to do that in certain cases. We are not asking people to reduce their demand where possible. We are actually incentivizing energy demand, because in all this, governments are strongly intervening by subsidizing energy consumption, electricity, gas, and oil, through measures that now are macroeconomically relevant. We are talking about 20, 30, 40 billion euros that countries like Italy, Spain, France, Germany have been pulling into this business of lowering energy prices since last September, in often an horizontal manner. So we are ending up in a situation where, during the worst energy crisis we are facing, we are subsidizing the refilling of a big SUV during the holiday period. I mean, this is clearly bad economic policy, but this is where governments so far have been on the defensive and, I would say, neglecting the situation. This clearly now has to change, because winter is coming, and with the winter, there will be no way to hide this situation anymore. And governments will need to be more outspoken, more clear, and I would say honest to people, because that's where we are, into a crisis.
So you are arguing then for, I mean, I see your point, but you're arguing then for only targeted subsidies, not so for horizontal.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, what governments must do, and this is something that now a lot of people have been telling, is to focus the support to vulnerable consumers and vulnerable small, medium enterprises. There is no reason to subsidize energy for the rich now, given that you would still like to see the price signal delivering on the necessary demand reduction that Georg and Ben were talking about before.
So, one message I think that perhaps we need to stop and repeat is that without a demand reduction, we are not going to get there. So therefore, find ways of reducing demand in ways that are fair and that they don't cause a big macroeconomic cost. I think that's a very important message to drive through. Also in keeping time, I'm looking at the time as well. I would like to discuss two more issues. One is what happens in the long term. There is some good news in the long term that I think is always good to flag out. This is pushing us in directions that we were going anywhere anyway. But I think it's important we're going there faster. I think that's an important thing. But I wanted to come back to the point that Simone just raised about what is all this mess and the way that we deal with means for the rest of the world. And I think that's also an important point, because in this process, we are not making any friends. We are already in a position where there is a lot of resentment in the way that in this war situation, a lot of resentment coming from poorer countries, countries that have, you know, in the past been on the receiving end of disadvantage. And all of this is adding to resentment. Simone, because you raised it, perhaps you can introduce a little bit the subject. I think it's important for our listeners to also understand that European actions have got impacts that go beyond our borders.
Yes. So if we look at the global scenario, I think at the beginning, Ben said it very clearly. Europe has managed to deal with the sharp decrease of the Russian gas exports into the continent with an increased share of LNG imports. So as a matter of fact, if you take June 2021, June 2022, you see that there has been a shift between Russia and LNG becoming the main supplier. So Europe is getting a lot of LNG cargoes. And of course, it is getting them because we are willing to pay for them at a very high price. Now, there are countries in the world that are not able to pay for these high prices. So what we are seeing is an energy crisis that is quickly spilling over from Europe to developing countries. So you see countries like Pakistan, like Bangladesh, that cannot buy LNG anymore. Therefore, they need to either switch to coal or to reduce demand, energy demand because they cannot cope with that. So you see blackouts, etc. So we are seeing this for gas. We are clearly seeing that for oil. We see in Africa, many protests are coming up because of the high energy prices, the high oil prices coped with high food prices. So we are into a sort of perfect storm, which is, of course, gonna affect the most vulnerable first, both within our countries and, of course, globally. So the global south will be affected significantly, possibly more than us, the Western nations, in this situation. And possibly this is something that was also, of course, well planned by the Kremlin.
Ben, you want to come in on this?
Sure. I think at the start, there was the number of the 15%, and that's what, as I framed it, that's the demand reduction needed to get off Russian gas. It is not so clear, because it should be emphasized, as Simona has done, that of the remaining stuff that we've replaced on LNG markets, this is still demand reduction, just not happening in Europe. The LNG market didn't suddenly grow. It increases every year, a couple of percentage points. Also oil, it doesn't grow. It's just we're now going into the market and pushing out other consumers who, if they're fortunate, might switch gas to coal for producing power, where it doesn't have too much of an impact. But when they're not fortunate, they just have to reduce energy demand.
So it's zero sum in this respect.
It's zero sum, yeah, zero sum game in LNG. And so far, okay, it's great that we have deep pockets and we're able to attract this for Europe, but for the world, and as you say, not making friends. I mean, the geopolitics of the world is pretty unstable, and now is the time to try and make friends, where I think making clear efforts that we're also doing our bits as much as we can to reduce demand, helping out others is really important. And then on oil. On oil, prices are high. They could get a lot higher because the Russian embargo still hasn't kicked in. And hypothetically, if Europe cuts Russian oil at the end of the year and goes on international markets to source this, again, there's not magically going to be more oil. Biden, I think, now is in Riyadh asking the Saudis, but I think their answer is they haven't got any more. It's quite clear. So again, Europe, on gas, we're starting hearing signs of reducing demand. On oil, nobody is really talking, as far as I see, about reducing demand. Yeah. But at some point, there will come a crunch. And then we are going to, again, be competing with the rest of the world and forcing demand reductions for oil in the rest of the world, which is, again, really, really damaging. Especially as there'll then be Russia sitting there with lots of oil. And if oil prices are sky high, then trying to negotiate with third countries not to buy Russian oil at cheap prices is impossible. If we don't do our bit to anyway crash prices by reducing demand, then it becomes a lot easier to negotiate with these countries and say, okay, hey, look, we give you X, Y, Z in return if you cooperate with us not buying Russian oil. If you keep consuming huge amounts of oil, push prices up, then it's easy for Russia to come with undercutting this and selling oil there.
Okay, well, no, I think that's clear. Perhaps we can spend maybe five minutes thinking about a little bit the longer term, the wider outlook of EU and global energy markets. I think there is points to be made there as well. I don't know, Georg, maybe you want to start first on sort of the beyond the problems of the next 6 months. What happens in the energy markets?
It will depend on politics. I mean, in the end, it will depend on what we do now during the crisis and how we set our priorities for getting out of the crisis. In a benign scenario where the European Union essentially pulls together, implements the Repower EU plan, installs more renewables faster, invests in energy efficiency and tries to reduce demand also in the short term, and maintains its institutions, we might be able to essentially outpace our initial plans of decarbonization quite substantially, and might help the world to have cheaper and more reliable energy. The risk is that that policymakers think that this is going to be too complicated, too expensive, and it's much easier to kind of in the short term try to outbid others and try to get energy from buying it off others. And I mean, we are seeing signs in both directions. So in the later directions, there's a massive glut now of LNG terminals being installed. There are new coal mines being under discussion. There is discussion on on producing more gas in Europe. So there's also fossil investment plans that have reemerged. That we also the question about German coal phase out, for example, is on the table again, whether it's 2030, 2038, or even even later. So those discussions might come back. So it will be a very, very complex question for policymakers to bring across the message to population that if we manage now to pull through with European solutions and in the same time implement the renewable and energy efficiency policies that are in the RePowerEU plan, we might be able to get there. But it is easy to see all the cracks in the system. I mean, we see the European electricity market starting to kind of diverge. Some member states do not want to participate in normal price-based electricity trading anymore because they are afraid of the social implications of that. We see discussions on whether we really need high carbon prices in a situation where prices are anyway so high. And I see substantial political risks here and a bit of a gap of political leadership saying kind of that that's the only way that we could sensibly go.
So there is, in a minute before we finish, I'm going to ask you to give me your top three priorities in terms of what we need to do now. And I mean now to meet the energy crisis, right? But before I go there, I want to touch on one more point. I know you, all three of you, and all of us at Bruegel and beyond, actually, we care deeply about climate. And we have worked very hard to get to where we are now. And we all know, certainly in this podcast, that we haven't done enough to get to where we need to get to. So can you talk, certainly for the benefits of our audience, a little bit about how much all of this is setting us back in terms of our climate objectives? Because we all understand the crisis and we need to do what we need to do, but we need to also know how this match is setting us back. Simone?
Well, I think that we have been there already, no? So you remember in the early days of the pandemic when the European Green Deal was just announced, many out there said, okay, that's the end of this fabulous plan. Now we have a pandemic to deal with. Let's, you know, forget about the green priority. I think we managed to actually turn the recovery, namely with Next Generation EU, into an opportunity to speed up the green transition. So that was, I think, a successful case of how we reacted to a crisis by accelerating green investments, etc. Now, I think the EU plan, RePowerEU, has all the good ingredients to go in the same direction this time. So the idea that we now need to not only increase our renewable energy and energy efficiency targets for 2030, but really accelerate over the next months the permitting process of renewables, etc. This is all action that can accelerate the green transition, but action must be taken at the national level. We need to understand that the EU can provide guidance, can push politically this agenda, but the difficult measures must be undertaken at the national level. National governments are the ones that can simplify the regulatory framework for renewables, accelerate the permitting processes, etc. So the answer to your question is related to how serious governments are. Again, it's a political choice because the technology is there, the investors are there. We need the politics to clear the way and allow these investments to be rolled out much quicker than before.
Well, all of this is good and clear, but we are still opening coal mines. And we're doing it because we need to. We're not doing it because we like it, but we need to. And all of these things that are polluting the environment when we are moving in the opposite direction, how is that setting us back, Ben?
But I would be more optimistic on the climate outlook. I would frame it as gas, natural gas and cheap Russian gas was seen as the transition fuel for Europe's energy transformation over the next 20 years. And hence every scenario, every policy analysis always factored in, we're going to consume lots of gas until 2045 even. And now all of a sudden, for non-climate reasons, that's not possible. So you pull this transition fuel, kind of this glue between different systems out, and you have to survive without it. So in the short run, it does mean indeed that we haven't built out renewables, heat pumps, electrification solutions. So you do have to boost coal and you do have to take dirty solutions in the short run. But in the long run, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, I don't think any serious person is proposing that we go back to coal for producing electricity. They're proposing that we massively roll up renewables and demand side flexibility, and this is the solution. And it's not even climate, it's just economics. That's the cheapest solution. It's difficult to get there, and there's lots of challenges still, but I see it again as this kind of force that now is pushing you there, which is this sucking out of the system of gas. That's no longer, it was kind of this easy thing to fall back on. It was a bit more clean burning, quite cheap, and it's no longer there. So for me, long term, I would still be positive in the forces that push us. I mean, as Georg said, it is all about politics, where I would take a step back, and I mean, anything can happen in politics, but still the environment I see as being more conducive towards lower carbon emissions in 5, 6 years' time.
So you're saying it's effectively a very short run, all this back road that we have to do, and effectively it will be absorbed in the next horizon of 3, 4 years, exactly. And certainly in the long run. So it won't make a significant compromise of our climate objectives. Is that how I read it?
I think that it is a compromise between accepting in the next 2 years dirty solutions that we don't like, even burning oil in gas turbines, for example, and you have nasty things, local air pollution, etc. Potentially just to keep the economy running, we have to accept this. But the compromise is then we go much more aggressive over the coming years on the plans we already had, which the RePowerEU essentially doubles down. It takes all the numbers and times them by 1.5, and that's now the new targets.
Georg, you share Ben's optimism?
Yes, yeah, somewhat. I think it depends on politics. If kind of the policymakers that care for climate are essentially going to say, guys, okay, we are allowing you deviations from the past, but only if you allow us to go much more aggressively on the green front, then I think we are going to get there. I think a compromise can be forged here. It is quite clear from the kind of cumulative emissions, we can be in a better world with accepting 2 more years of a bit more coal burn, but then at the same time pushing renewables and energy efficiency much further. Again, a political question. What is important to me, and maybe coming to your last part with the recommendations, I think we should protect institutions. So in Europe, there is a significant risk that institutions such as emission trading or European market arrangements are going to be undermined through national measures in the crisis. So we should not let the crisis divide us, but try to protect the institutions that were good and helpful, and try to stabilize them and strengthen them rather than undermining. Some of those institutions have been built for 20 years. Think of the emission trading system or the electricity market again. And just throwing them out of the window now will have huge long-term implication and cost for the efficiency of the decarbonization in Europe. So my one message would be try to protect the institutions.
So like ETS, it's interesting. There's been an interesting discussion about ETS last week about this. But no, this is the time to draw conclusions. And I'd like you to try and be as concrete as possible. Next 6 months, which is really where the problem is, limiting the damage that we do to the environment now at the in order to meet this crisis and protect the future. So Simone, why don't you go first?
Yes, I mean, if I have to say three priorities, I would say, first of all, demand reduction, because that's the low-hanging fruit for Europe. But we can make ourselves more resilient if we all consume less and if we have a planned, you know, demand reduction also in the industrial sector. So that's, in my view, the first priority. The second is to ensure coordination and real solidarity among the European countries, because we cannot let Putin divide and rule strategy prevail. And the third point is let's focus our efforts on protecting the most vulnerable citizens. We cannot let these crises further increase the problem of inequality we have in our society. So policymakers, in my view, should really switch quickly from general universal measures to measures that are targeted to protect the most vulnerable in this very difficult scenario.
And if you were, Simona, if you were to pick measures directly to reduce demand and to ensure that there is better, I'm not optimal, but better coordination among you, are there specific things that you would like to do?
I think, to be very concrete, I think that we have taken an important step in the last weeks and couple of months with the establishment of an EU energy platform. The Commission has been surprisingly quick in setting up also an institutional structure to deal with this new initiative that is a little bit a cornerstone of RepowerEU. I think we now need to turn this instrument into a real instrument that can really help Europe to tackle with the crisis of the next months. And that entails stronger coordination of the TSOs, for example, to coordinate the flow of the gas molecules across Europe. That entails also an element, I think, of mutualization. So having a small European instrument that can mutualize part of this cost to get the LNG we need for the storage refilling, etc. That's extremely important. And again, if we look back at the experience of Next Generation EU, I think that mutualization element made possible also a stronger unity and a strong support for the EU action vis-à-vis the pandemic. We can do the same here vis-à-vis the energy crisis.
Ben?
First one, you might also guess, is reducing demand, which I won't expand on given that we talked about this half the podcast. Second one would be European integration, deeper integration, and...
What do you mean, European integration?
Thinking about this as a European game and working together to try and get through concretely, or thinking that if we maximized all the redundancies and elements in different countries for the benefits of everyone and treated them as if we wanted to, where we would be. As an example, the Groningen field in the Netherlands. Imagining if the Netherlands is quite well provided, they're quite well off. If that wasn't in another country, Bulgaria, for example, somewhere else, it would be running. I mean, they would have found it. I'm sure they would have found solutions. They would have negotiated with the people, paid them what they need, and now be running this at max capacity. And if you ask me the concrete solution, how you get this integration, I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's always a problem with the European Union. It's not, of course, one country. But how are we going to think together, particularly in the next months, of designing mechanisms that allow better functioning of markets and more solidarity is key. I'm sorry, that's not so concrete and it's difficult to see how. I mean, it essentially comes in the council and the leaders sitting in the room having real discussions and really working together to help each other and seeing this external threat of Russia is much bigger than any kind of internal politics we have going on at the moment. And the final thing would be largely on the build-out of renewables, but also other solutions, a bit of a changing priorities or changing the way we think about these, that we can no longer go in the way we were in the past of, particularly on renewables, long permitting periods and taking 8-10 years to build projects. Now it essentially needs to be almost a war economy for building out renewables. Mm. In the North Sea, for example, the targets are incredible for how much offshore wind we need to build over the next 10 years. And we're nowhere near on course to meet them. And something has to change now if we ever want to meet those targets. And that's, again, probably going to be countries speaking together with the company sitting down, locking themselves in a room and not coming out till they found a solution for how we can deploy huge gigawatts of offshore wind interconnected to all the countries there around the North Sea immediately and start working on it yesterday. And the same around Europe for deploying these solutions, which at least in the political debate, I still don't see since the invasion. The RepowerEU is nice and it's nice that we have the targets and the roadmap for where to get. But in national capitals, there are not really yet aggressive policies for building out more the longer term solutions. So my third point is a bit beyond the 6-month period, but it's important we start on that today. Also to have a belief in where we are going and to back up what I said earlier about this should be the opportunity for climate transition.
Georg, I'd like to give you maybe the last word also, if you can give us a few, pick one or two of concrete measures where you think they can make a difference in the short run.
My feeling is that the real great way out of the crisis would be to strike a big bargain. And I'm not sure whether it's in the cards, but it would help us a big deal. And the big bargain would essentially consist of member states getting together and looking into their eyes and say, okay, we are bringing all the supply flexibilities that we have to the front. The Germans on nuclear and lignite, the Dutch on Groningen, the Polish on imports from Ukraine and so on. It's all politically difficult in all of those countries, but that would be one element of the big bargain. The second element of the big bargain would be an agreement not to subsidize demand, but to subsidize demand reduction, and to really pull out a lot of money to pay consumers in different countries, from Bulgaria over Portugal to Sweden, for reducing their consumption. The third element would be to keep the market open, to make sure that the flow, that the volumes that have been saved and the volumes that have been on top brought into the system are then brought to the countries that are most in need of them. And then the before last element would be to pool money together in order to make sure that those that are most responsible for the crisis are going to pay a bit more for that, and that the burden is shared. And the final element is social compensation, which also should be part of this big pool. So if we were able to draw together such a big bargain between member states on things that are quite difficult, because they imply kind of politically hard choices on production, choices on kind of reducing demand, choices on mutualization of cost, and kind of cross-border solidarity, we will be getting out of this crisis in a strengthened way, and we can kind of look down to Putin and not need his gas anymore. And I think that would be an sort of ideal situation. We have still a few months to prepare that. On the 20th of July, the Commission is going to come up with their proposal. On the 27th, the Energy Council is meeting, and in October, the European Council is meeting. But if we go like in the pandemic, with kind of waiting until it's too late and then pull together, I mean, this crisis is cumulative. I mean, we are not kind of getting out here by just waiting and seeing, and we need to act preemptively.
Wonderful, Georg. I think this is very nice and concrete. It looks very much like we've got our work cut out for us in the next 6 months. Ben's use of language was a bit worrying sometime, a war economy, you know, but maybe that is the frame of mind that we need if we are going to understand the urgency of the situation. And with that, let me thank you, all three of you, for participating, but also for the excellent work that you're doing to inform us and to make sure that the right decisions, to help make the right decisions. For the audience, you can read all the great work that Georg, Simone and Ben are writing on our newly launched website, actually, and more on all the things that Bruegel are doing. Follow us on bruegel.org. And that's all we have time for today. I hope we will have a few more podcasts before we take a summer break. But for today, this is all we have time for. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Simone. Thank you, Georg. Thank you, Ben. Bye-bye.